okay?
No.
I know you're not saying that.
Yeah, that's
some,
right.
You're
going to
go over the work plan.
That's 15 years.
The House Committee on Revenue will come to order. And thank you all for prompt attendance on a beautiful sunny morning when there's a lot going on. We have two items to deal with in the next 25 minutes, and then we meet jointly with the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. So let's go to the first one, which is the adoption of interim committee rules. Manson?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, you have in front of you in your packet the House Interim Committee on Revenue suggested rules. These are primarily a boilerplate that are adopted to govern your work for the interim, and they're here basically to update with the latest rules that we have for the interim.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair.
I move approval of the House Interim Committee on Revenue Rules.
Representative Berger moves the adoption of the rules as printed. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing no objection, the rules are adopted. Thank you. Next is the interim committee work plan. Mazin, why don't you go ahead and review that with us, and then we'll have a conversation about it.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, the interim committee work plan, this is the modified work plan from the last time you've met when you had the draft, had a little discussion on what needed to be added and what needed to come out, and basically it looks like this is the product after that shakeup. So the ones that seems to have a very high likelihood of continuing is the primary issue, the 911 tax base, this issue of the treatment of the prepaid telecommunication services. Co-Chair Berger is deeply in control and involved in that.
No, not in control, enmeshed. In control of nothing.
In control of the thought. The corporate tax issues, excuse me, the cost of performance and calculation of the kicker. Then the vehicle road usage charges, these are the issues along with the transportation issues that you've dealt with in the previous session on how and when to phase in the road use charges. And we will have that also, and then the property taxes and the tribal property, which also some of it would be looked at today, and so refine some concepts that were introduced in the 11th session and perhaps introduce bills for the 12th. Then the interstate competitiveness on Oregon tax system, local finance issues. These have to deal with the issues that we're facing today with the fall and reductions of the values, market value, and so on, and how they interact with Measure 5 and 50. And finally, you have the reserve fund policy. And those are the issues that are prominent in this interim. And to continue things that are continuing from the previous session and things that seem to be in a continuation of other work, we'll have a follow-up and monitoring of revenue trends and the revenue forecast, of course, that you would be receiving during the interim. Then you have the implementation of the senior property tax deferral program. Those are the changes that you've done in the previous session. Same thing with the energy tax credits, impact of the tax compliance and the estate tax reform, the one that was done in the 11th session. and Measure 66 and 67 collections. Now, all of that, of course, would be either an introduction for potential 2012 legislation that would come in November. And those are the issues that might be introduced as a result of that work.
Okay, yes, Representative Berger.
As in, remind me, you have 7 bullet points under possible legislation. How many actual committee bills do we get in the interim?
I think we get...
So we have 7 bullet points, and my chair is indicating 5.
Right.
And I can tell you that the 911 thing, I really would like to introduce 3 different options on the 911 thing.
Hmm.
Now, I can combine them possibly into one bill, and we can peel sections off as we consider it and save ourselves. And I'm willing to spend one of my precious...
5.
Because I'm up to my ears in it. But I can tell you that we've got way more than... And I don't know... I mean, some of these issues are huge and will require... if we don't have something to do with our Betsy changes... I'll be shocked. The same with, I mean, we did some enormous things that I would anticipate. So I'm just pointing out that we may have a little issue, and if members of the Revenue Committee have spare bills that they're not going to use, they might consider some of the issues that we're dealing with.
Other, yes, Mr. Bailey.
I think that's an excellent point. Madam Co-Chair, I'd say that there may be also other committees we could look to partner on where there's a nexus with those issues as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the Senate Finance and Revenue also is looking at the work plan, and you might have some liberty.
Oh,
they might start some
they
bills.
Have 5, too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They might start some bills. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had offered one of my bills for the clarification of tribal property for tax purposes, so that would take one of those off that list. But that's the aside. I actually wanted to talk about one of the in-depth issue bullet points on the first page, and it's under the vehicle. It's the third bullet point, vehicle road usage charges, how and when to phase in. I don't like that phraseology. It should be whether and when as opposed to how and to. So anyway, I'd like that rephrased because I don't think the decision's been made.
But I think that's a reasonable.
So would it be okay that we simply add the word whether at the beginning?
That would
so
work.
So it would be whether,
that would work.
How, and when, or words to that effect?
No, words to that effect.
We'll leave it to staff to
please
do the wordsmithing.
Thank you.
I think that's a great comment. Other discussion? I would simply echo some of the things that Representative, my co-chair, has already said, but I also would note that issues always come up in this committee in November or December before. We've had the 2 special February sessions in the past. Our history has been that there's always at least 1 or 2 late-breaking issues that we absolutely have to deal with. We always go to the Rules Committee and ask them for extra bills, and they've always given them to us if we've had to have them. So I know that this work plan is going to be different in February than it is now. The only problem is I can't tell you what the new things are because they haven't come up yet. And I am not at all bashful when issues arise to asking rules for the right to introduce more bills.
And we may.
Yeah.
Since both your co-chairs are on rules, we might be able to persuade them.
I might be able to persuade them. Representative Gelser. No, okay. Anything else on the interim work plan? Oh, one other thing, quickly. Please take this home, look at it, dream about it. I do, unfortunately. And if there are additional concepts that come to mind, please contact LRO and your co-chairs. Yes, Representative Burr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one comment under corporate tax issues. The second sub-bullet point, calculation of the kicker and treatment of tax credits under the corporate minimum. Those, I believe, are 2 entirely different issues.
Yes.
That should be separated.
I agree. Thank you. Can we do that? Separate those 2? It's this, right there. There you go.
Thank you.
Thank you. I agree with that. Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Benson and I were looking over the work plan down here and noticed an old friend missing, and we were wondering if that was concrete or wishful thinking, estate tax.
Actually, it does exist under the monitoring and follow-up issues. And it's very possible that we'll end up with a bill because of some glitch in the bill that we passed. It's very possible.
Yeah.
Complex issues almost always require us to revisit.
And that was my comment about bills, because all of those may take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hopefully it's on a cruise control for now.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yes. Anything else on this one? Now, the next item of work is the information meeting at 8:30. We're meeting with the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee at 8:30. So that's when I should recess to. Yes, we'll recess until 8:30 when we meet jointly with the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee.
we will reconvene the committee on, the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue.
And the House Committee on Revenue. It's 8:30, as you all can see, and we are ready to move on to the next item, property tax exemptions and tribal governments. Justin, I want to bring your panel. While he's coming up, I'll simply note that we have times scheduled for our information meetings today, and I think we're getting booted at 11 o'clock, aren't we? So we have to adjourn by 11 o'clock, so let's keep as close to the time schedule as we can. Gentlemen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin. I am here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member. Thank you very much for this opportunity today to talk about some leftover legislation from the 2011 session, House Bill 2566. What I've handed out in front of you guys today, kind of the first piece, is a memo that essentially outlines what we'd like to talk about for reintroduction of this legislation in the February session. And boy, we are very thankful that we now have annual sessions and we're able to come back and not have to wait till every other year. So thank you very much for that. Thanks to Oregonians for that. In this memo, we outline the following terms that we think should be recognized and should be looked at for the purposes of discussion today. You can see that is in subsection A, looking at tribal administration, tribal facilities, fire, police, tribal health facilities, education, transportation, low-income housing, fish, wildlife management, utility services provided to tribal communities, and lands acquired specifically for archaeological protection and ceremonial cultural sites. So we'd like to begin the discussions with those terms. With me today is the perspectives that you will hear today. One are from me and a Western Oregon tribe in Grand Ronde. Two, actually third, but you'll be hearing from an Eastern Oregon tribe, Warm Springs, with Michael Mason, and then hearing from Dave Tovey, who's the only tribal officer on the panel and the one that really knows his stuff up here today. So that'll be how the panel will work. And with that, I'd just like to talk briefly, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair and Madam Chair, about the government-to-government process in Oregon. And it's something that, you know, in my 15 years being involved with the legislature, I personally am very proud of, and I'm very proud as an Oregonian, and I'm very proud of my legislature in the work that we've been able to do. Oregon is really a unique state when it comes to state-tribal relations, and that's something we can all be proud of, and it's something that this legislature in 2011 and legislatures in the past have really made a commitment to do, and it's one that makes us stand out from every other state. So thank you for that. In looking at a bill like this, what we're really looking to do is get to the point of equality and looking for the same benefits that other recognized governments in Oregon have afforded to them. So you'll see I've actually given you a list of Grand Ronde's testimony today, and what it contains is an actual schedule. If you go to the second and the third page, there's a fee property tax table that lists all of our fee properties in and around Oregon, most around Yamhill and Polk. And if you guys are can take a look at that today, and if there are questions on that, certainly feel free to ask. But Grand Ronde, along with the other Oregon tribes, the Department of Revenue, and the Association of Counties have worked cooperatively to bring this legislation in front of you today. We think it does bring governments closer in treatment to state, public, and municipal corporations with regard to taxation of governmental property. We appreciate these efforts, which ultimately lead to us being able to offer services to our tribal members throughout the state. A lot of our tribal members, as a terminated tribe, were moved from the reservation and have located throughout Oregon. As you know, we do have government offices in both Portland and Eugene. Those offices include assistance for tribal members in the areas of social services, workforce training, education, cultural activities, and economic development. We think that by providing local off-reservation services and opportunities to our tribal members in those areas actually lessens the burden on the county governments, which would end up seeing our members who live in those areas as well. So with that, thank you very much for opening this discussion. We look forward to February, and we look forward to coming back in November and working with the committee and ultimately passing legislation that, again, gets us to where we need to be in terms of being a recognized government here in Oregon. So with that, thank you very much again for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Tovey. I'm a tribal member, descendant of Cayuse and Joseph Van Nez Perce, full blood on my mother's side. Obviously, I've inherited my father's Welsh attributes, and I'm having to apologize to my fellow tribal members constantly about that. I need to do some quick introductions here. With me is Vice Chairman of our Board of Trustees, our elected governing authority, Leo Stewart, in the front row. And with us also is Bruce Zimmerman, our tax administrator. And Bruce has spent a number of years in the Oregon Department of Revenue, too. So he's our staff expert. Obviously, we're here to talk about the mechanics, really, of trying to provide governmental services to tribal members and other reservation residents and people that live next to us. When we're providing municipal services, as any municipality has to do, fire, police, water, sewer, zoning, we don't try to differentiate those services or systems, but a lot of those non-Indian residents that live on or near us are incidental beneficiaries of those services. We don't have a tax base as such, so we're always trying to craft ways to either reduce the cost of those services or justify its use and ways of how do we pay for that. We really appreciate the support in the last legislative session on this bill. We really appreciate the feedback we had from members of the committee explaining to us where we had to get better definition on particular areas, and we've worked fairly hard in this little recess period to try to do that better. I've submitted some written testimony. Hopefully we can have that entered into the record with the committee's permission. The details, a number of things, and we, as Gran Ron did, have, I think it's about the fourth page back, did an inventory of the lands that we feel are otherwise qualified under the definitions of this proposed legislation. Most of them are wildlife mitigation lands, and you can see that the total dollar amount is fairly nominal to that point. We also in there have an example of a current project going on out on our west, on our eastern boundary of the reservation on Meacham Creek. That's a major undertaking of stream restoration and actually stream relocation along the Union Pacific Railroad corridor for fish management. We're doing that in cooperation with other state agencies along with federal. We do want to have an open invitation for the members of the committee or any members of the legislature to come and visit that project at your convenience, and we'd love to show you the work we're doing. We know there's a couple of kind of dangling terms that were brought up, and we offer several options, and hopefully these are fair approaches. We know that archaeological protection was one concern, and we'll just cite that ORS 358.9110 provides some of that definition. We would suggest that might be a fair definition to have for this purpose. We were doing some quick research and looking around, even talking with the state SHPO office. I think when those sites are identified, they're typically an acre or less in size, where we need to tighten that up in its definition. All right, but I think those are fairly small scale properties anyway, as opposed to maybe what some of the concerns were expressed. Fish and Wildlife Management, like I said, we submitted some testimony there in my written testimony. We just think that there's a lot of properties that we're doing a lot of really good common purpose activities on. By way of how a lot of times the funding comes down, there's other requirements with that, including access, public access to those properties. By keeping them in fee status, it keeps us true to those purposes, and also keeps those costs of operation down. I think the big thing for us that we want to stress, we understand the nature of probably the core of the concern. If it's not a governmental purpose, we know there's no exemption. If there's anything we're doing that has a commercial aspect to it, we know that's the acid test. If we're making money from it, if we have a piece of farm property that we're generating revenue from, off the table. If it's forested land that we're going to cut and timber, off the table. If it's a commercial venture, off the table. But we do believe that there's some core governmental systems and core governmental services that we provide that by fairness and terms of other units of government should not be taxed. And again, I think for us, we know that the committee was interested in seeing a better definition of how much that was. I know some of the people who are tracking this bill wanted to see how much it was. We know it's a dollar issue, so I think we've tried to define that accordingly. And with that, members of the committee, I'll wrap up my testimony, if that's fine. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Good morning, Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, and Chair Burdick. For the record, my name is Michael Mason. I'm here representing the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs and want to talk briefly about kind of House Bill 2566-2, as we're calling it, but mostly I'm here to answer questions because it's a somewhat complicated area. I want to just talk a little bit about the history to follow on to what Justin and Mr. Tubby have talked about with the government-to-government relationship. 35 years ago, at the time of the American Bicentennial, the United States Bicentennial, there were only two federally recognized tribes in the state, the Umatilla and the Warm Springs tribes. The rest were not considered tribes or had actively been terminated by the U.S. Congress in the 1950s. That termination policy was applied most thoroughly in Oregon and caused some terrible hardship, caused basically a diaspora of the tribal members in the five affected tribes. Oregonians right about the time of the Bicentennial realized the error inherent in unilaterally terminating a government, and leaders like the late Senator Marco Hatfield, who you'll be honoring this weekend, stepped up to correct the error, and he was engaged in every single Restoration Act. A great leader, a man of great compassion, grew up, little known fact, grew up partly on the Siletz Reservation because his mother was a teacher there. And I could go on and on about the senator. I could take the rest of my time just on his achievements for justice for Indian people. But did want to mention him as a critical player in getting us to the point we are today where you have nine tribes and tribes in a position to, with some reservation area, to be able to come to you, to actually be able to hire lobbyists and so forth. Very important to us, a couple of us here. But for the last 10 years, the Legislative Assembly has required state agencies to, quote, promote positive government-to-government relationships between the state and tribes. That's reading from, as you know, Senate Bill 770, a landmark piece of legislation. And the process of government-to-government, I will tell you, is the envy of tribes across the country. The process here, the relationship here, is probably the best in the entire United States between the state and tribes. There's one gap still. There may be more than one gap, but in terms of the treatment of tribes, the power to tax is the power to destroy, we've often heard. Governments really shouldn't have the power to destroy each other. Tribes already got destroyed at one point virtually with the termination. We'd like to see this for all of the tribes as getting to the next level where it's understood that the tribal lands, the tribal properties used for governmental purposes shouldn't be taxed any more than, a county building should be taxed that isn't, at least to the extent it's not leased out for some commercial use. So we have worked with the Department of Revenue on this, and Elizabeth Harshenko, when she was there, was very helpful in the initial drafting. So I'm happy to answer questions and appreciate your thorough consideration of this proposal.
Thank you. I'm sorry, did you have other people to call?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no.
Okay, thank you. We have a few minutes then for questions, comments, discussion. Yes, Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not being familiar with the issues related to the tribes and particularly property taxation, I just want to clear, at first blush, I have some concerns that I'm hoping you can address, and I have just a few questions. The first is, does this exemption apply to both land and personal property, not just to land?
Mr. Chair and Representative Brewer, the answer would be yes, as we understand it. Now, I want to make the point with that, you know, this is a tax exemption we're talking about. It's not a tax immunity, so they are narrowly construed. I mean, the experience, and the Umatillas know this far better than we, but the experience in Washington with a similar law is, you know, you take this to the assessor, you take a parcel to the assessor, you say, hey, this is for government purposes. And the assessor then makes a determination, is it really, you know, for government purposes, may cut out some of the, say there's a structure that's not necessarily used for government purposes in the assessor's mind, or assessment, I should say. So it's narrowly construed, but it does cover personality.
Yeah, please.
A couple follow-ups. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the schedules that you've given us, address the land, which we see is very small on the land, but not the personal property impact. This also applies then to future acquisitions of property, correct?
Yes.
Both real and personal. And so to piggyback on that, then a follow-up then, in essential government services, utilities, in looking at that definition, I appreciate the exploration of trying to define that because I think it would be rather difficult. You're trying to bring parity to the tribes with other governments in the state of Oregon and the property tax exemptions that they have. I think that's what I heard you say. So do other governments in the state of Oregon, and this I really don't know, when I look at the definition of utility services, I know that there's some public utility districts and so on and so forth, but when I look at utility services, do other government services have property exempted, both real and personal, in each one of these areas? And the ones that are bothersome to me are the cable and data service, internet service, radio and television, and perhaps broadband service, wireless communication, which is somewhat broad. So I just, do you know if there's parity there? Are there other governments in Oregon that are exempted, that have those types of properties that are exempted?
John's here. Phillips is here, too.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Ira Brewer, we understand that they are. And we worked out this language with the Association of Oregon Counties. But I don't want to speak for, I'm not speaking for the counties, obviously. I'm not speaking for Department of Revenue. But there is a person from each of those entities here. So if you wanted to address that question to them, that would be probably more helpful.
Okay. Other questions? Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you. As you gentlemen know, I became enmeshed in this thing later in this, towards the end. And from my point of view, police, fire, health, education, transportation, some of these are pretty no-brainers. Those are government services that all of us can identify with. The two that were complicated were, of course, the utility services, as she's indicated, and, of course, the fish and wildlife management one. And you have indicated by your data here how prescribed or constrained that is. But the important question that she just asked, and this is the question that we're struggling with here, at least I'm struggling with, is that in the natural resource arena, you can designate, because you are your own government, this whole swash of land here is a habitat area, and add to what you've listed here sort of without the counties having a whole lot to say about it, and I think that is the real concern here in terms of taking a whole bunch of land off of the property tax rolls. What's your response to that? And do you have an answer for this, your ability to just say, this is natural habitat, let's take acres and acres off the tax roll?
Well, Madam Co-Chair, if I may, most the ones we have were actually prescribed as part of the wildlife mitigation settlement we have with BPA. It's specific to those purposes. That's where the money came from to acquire the land. So it's pretty specific that way. I think there's examples that we've been trying to identify and have identified with some cities that do identify wildlife corridors and other kind of natural resource protection things. But except for, unless we're going to do those things from a mitigation standpoint, I don't think we'd be blocking off those properties, or they would withstand the assessor's examination as far as being wildlife areas. I think that's probably.
Yeah, if I could
help me with that, Michael. I think if I could, one other quick point. I think you can see from our inventory too. Most often, those are on farm or forest deferral prices too. So you can see even the large acreages that we have in our testimony were fairly nominal taxes anyway. So I think that's at least another consideration. And,
yes, I get that. Now I'm. We enact this land, this law, and what's, you know, what are the constraints to keep that from just burgeoning into a huge issue?
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair.
Yes.
I'm out of practice.
We got
the summer.
4 minutes here.
Okay. As Mr. Tovey has said, you know, the lands, and this is also true of Warm Springs, the lands that would come under this fish and wildlife purpose are lands purchased by with money from Bonneville Power Administration for mitigation of fish and wildlife damage. So you have, if you were to look at this normatively, I guess, you have a situation where the whole purpose of the land and the funding for it has to be for wildlife. So, for example, if you turn around 20 years from now and decide, oh, we have some great ponderosa pine stand here, let's log it, that's going to be commercial. I would expect that to be taxed, or that parcel then to be taxed, and it might even revert to BPA. I mean, we have to keep it in that that status. We can't do commercial activity without it reverting to BPA. Now, prospectively, then, the question, I also understand that, you know, these parcels generally have some involvement of OWEB with funding to restore habitat. So, Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. This is, I agree, an issue that we need to discuss. And we'll be talking with the counties and DOR about how to do this in a way that doesn't create the risk that you're talking about. So.
Thank you.
Representative Bance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, as you know, I've offered one of my two bills to the tribes for this purpose. I've contacted at least two of you on the panel and one other. I haven't heard much back. If you want to use my bill, I'll need to hear from you so that I can work with you on it.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So I'm looking at page 2, line 10, and there's a term that I don't see defined in the amendments that we're looking at. And the phrase specifically that I'm looking at is utility services provided to tribal communities. I'm wondering, I'm new to this, so bear with me. What do we mean by tribal communities? Are we talking about a geographical area, or are we talking about individuals that are tribal members?
I'll just have a general statement. Mr. Co-Chair and Madam Chair and Madam Chair and Representative Wand, in reference to, there are definitions around Indian country. So, for example, in Grand Ronde, we have a health and wellness center, and it serves the entire 35-mile area radius, tribal members and non-tribal members. Physicians from the local cities have actually moved their practices there. That would be considered a tribal community. Specific to Representative Ira Brewer's questions, we have had those conversations with the representatives from Verizon. We will certainly have that with other representatives, our colleagues, about that. Our intention in looking at telecommunications, we don't have large enough communities to be able to offer our own cable systems or our own internet systems, but we may like to provide for those companies to come into the reservation, as we came in here and worked in the 2009 session, to be able to entice them to come on the reservation and actually have a facility or have it nearby, so so we can then house the members of Verizon so we can get the benefits from that. And John Phillips is in the room from Department of Revenue, and we will make sure to get that question answered for you if other governments do that in terms of the people that provide those services, whether it's 911, whether it's for fire, whether it's for police, et cetera. So we definitely want to, we have very large contracts with those companies, and if we can offer that to them, you know, as some type of service, that's something that we definitely want to look into, because we see those emergency services as well as communications as an essential government service. So we will definitely get back to you with those answers. And in terms of Indian country, yes, it can be defined somewhat.
Thank you. We're out of time. Do you want to have a very, it's a very,
very, very, very brief. Yeah, I wasn't asking the question as an advocate. I mean, I just want to get a handle on what the policy is and what tribal communities means in this context. So if you can help me understand that, that'd be very helpful to me.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah,
we can do it offline. It's fine.
I think it's very important to note that this bill raised a lot of questions. We were late getting to it in the session, in the odd number year session. I hope we don't have that problem this time. At the end of the session, I asked, and I think my co-chair joined in that request, that Representative Bentz lead the work group on the issue. And he's graciously offered to present the bill. I think you've heard repeated today a number of the questions, not all of them, but a number of the questions that we had back in May and June. I think it's critical that we get answers to those questions and that the work group be able to present a bill that is clear, that really defines what it is that's covered by it, and with some clarity. My suspicion is it will be much longer than the Dash 6 amendments. I don't know that, but I suspect it will be, in order to make it clear. And I would urge you to work with Representative Bentz in order to get that in shape for February. Anything else? Thank you very much. We really appreciate your presentation this morning.
Thank you.
And we have our work cut out for us, I think, before February. 9 o'clock, reverse mortgages and senior property tax deferral program, Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, wherever she may be, and Chair Burdick, my name is Lou Savage. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We've been asked to give just a very brief overview of reverse mortgages. As you probably know, our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities regulates mortgage lenders, mortgage bankers. We license loan originators, and we regulate state chartered banks and credit unions. So we have some familiarity with reverse mortgages as we regulate those entities. With me today, and the guy who's going to be doing the heavy lifting, is Fernando Valles, who's the consumer information specialist. I will tell you that we have not been involved in the issue of the senior property tax exemption, although Fernando certainly has had contact with consumers who have seen this issue, and so that's the reason that he's the guy who's going to be not only presenting this, but answering any questions you might have about it. So with that, I'll turn it over to Fernando.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Fernando Velez. I'm the Consumer Information Specialist for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities under the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Some of my responsibilities include maintaining the foreclosure website sponsored by the Department of Consumer and Business Services current. I also to provide the foreclosure brochure available for consumers. Reverse mortgages are a special type of home loan which converts a portion of the equity into cash. They are available to homeowners who are 62 years or of age or older. Through June 2011, they were...
Excuse me. I think you might distort a little bit less if you left a little bit more distance between you and the mic.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I have a loud voice. I know that. So through June 2011, there were 699 Federal Housing Administration reverse mortgages loans originated in Oregon. Of this, 67% were originated outside of the Portland metropolitan area, totaling over $180 million. The average Oregon reverse mortgage loan is about $81,000. For comparison purposes, in 2010, over 1,200 FHA reverse mortgage loans were originated in Oregon with a loan volume over $340 million. In 2010, there were more than 78,000 FHA insured reverse mortgage loan originated in the United States. In the past, some private lenders originated various versions of reverse mortgage loans. These are essentially non-existent today, leaving eventually two versions, one insured by Fannie Mae with a program called the Home Keeper, and the other one is insured by the Federal Housing Administration called the Home Equity Conversion Mortgage, commonly known as HECM. Today, only HECM loans are available and can only be originated by through an FHA-approved lender. HECM loans are FHA-insured as authorized by the Housing and Community Development Act of 1987 and are administered by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. HECM offers three types of reverse mortgages: a regular HECM, a HECM saver, and a HECM for purchase. Some of the basics of these reverse mortgages are that they can only be made on 1 to 4 unit family dwellings. At least one of those units should be owner-occupied, and some condominiums, FHA-approved condominiums, may qualify. The borrower must be either owning their home outright or have a very small lien or loan on the property. An existing lien must be paid off, and it can be done with the loan proceeds of a reverse mortgage. The loan is calculated on the age of the youngest borrower, a minimum of 62 years of age, current interest rates. The maximum claim will be the lesser of the appraised value of the property or $625,000, which is the current calculated limit for all Oregon counties, and this is through until December of 2011. The largest loan will be available when the borrower is older, the value of the home is higher, and the interest rates are lower. The borrower may choose from the following interest rate calculations. It can be a fixed rate, it can be an adjusted monthly, or it can be a rate adjustable annually. A lump sum distribution will be automatically be given a fixed rate. In other words, if a borrower chooses to get a lump sum, that will be an automatic fixed rate interest rate. Disbursements from a reverse mortgage can be made from a line of credit, monthly disbursements, a lump sum, or a combination of all of them. Loan proceeds from a reverse mortgage are not taxable, but they may affect eligibility for federal assistance programs such as Medicaid and Supplemental Security Income Program. It does not affect programs such as Social Security or Medicare because these are not based on the asset of the recipient. Some other characteristics of a HECM are it is a non-recourse loan, meaning that the borrower never owes more than the appraised value of the home. The surviving borrower or the state will not have to pay the loan if the balance exceeds the value of the home at the time of the sale. All recipients of a reverse mortgage must go through a mandatory homeowner counseling prior to initiating the loan application. The list of HUD-approved counselors is available on HUD's website or by calling AARP. Counseling can be face-to-face or by telephone, and the standard fee is about $125. To ensure borrowers understand a reverse mortgage, counselors will follow a protocol established by HUD called the Financial Interview Tool. Federal lending laws apply. Borrowers will receive a total annual loan cost, commonly known as TALC, which is required by the Truth in Lending Act, a good faith estimate under the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, and a 3-day right of cancellation. As part of the standard examinations of mortgage bankers and brokers, the Department of Consumer and Business Services reviews reverse mortgage loans. In particular, the examination verifies that the borrower has provided adequate and timely disclosures. The fees for home equity conversion mortgages are limited to a range of $2,500 to $6,000 maximum. These fees can be generally financed as part of the reverse mortgage loan. Property taxes and insurance are the responsibility of the borrower. Reverse mortgages do not establish escrow accounts.
I'm sorry, would you repeat that sentence again?
Absolutely. Property taxes and insurance are the responsibility of the borrower. Reverse mortgages do not establish escrow accounts. A reverse mortgage may be repaid at any time, but no later than at a time of the death of the last borrower or the home, or when the home is no longer occupied as a primary residence for at least 12 months. In other words, if the borrower moves out of the house for more than 12 months, such as to a care facility, then that will be no longer qualifying and the loan will have to be repaid. A Freedom of Information Act request will be necessary to collect data on the number of HECMs or homekeeper loans that have gone into foreclosure. So I'm ready for some questions if you have any.
Thank you. Could we get that material in writing, what you just gave us?
Yes,
that would
we
be,
have it.
Yeah. Did it come?
Yeah, I think you've got most of it. We could certainly provide you a little bit more detail.
It was in our original information.
Right. In the original information. Okay.
Right.
And we got a handout just now, and I assumed that was everything we had. But
we actually provided a little bit more to you today. And I wanted to point out one of the attachments is a breakdown by county of the reverse mortgages for January through June 2011.
Right. Yes. Senator Burdick.
Thank you. Just a couple questions. Just to make sure I understand from your testimony here, the reverse mortgage can be in an amount equal to the full appraised value of the house?
Co-chairs, Senator Burdick, not necessarily. So the lender will use the criteria based on the appraised value. In other words, that the lender will take the risk factor, and I think it's fair to compare that to what the lenders use to determine a risk factor for a regular loan, like a debt-to-income ratio. So the lender will determine, based on the appraised value, how risky, how much they're going to be lending based on the appraised value.
Okay, follow up.
Please, yes.
So how does that work in effect? Because our concern is with the reverse mortgage, if all the appraised value is taken up by the reverse mortgage, then there'll be nothing left to repay the state. So on the ground, basically what percentage of appraised value is typical for this?
Co-chair Senator Burdick, I've seen two specific cases where I determined that the loan to value were 61%. Typically, a loan will be around that much. Again, HUD provides with a guideline about as to how risky the lender would want to be. So I will say, based on those two case scenarios that I looked at, there will be about 60 to 65% loan to value.
Which would mean 30 to 35% remaining.
Correct.
When the loan has to be replaced. And another question, Mr. Chair.
Please, yes.
We have some anecdotal reports that the people who issue these mortgages are advising people who get the mortgages to get onto the property tax deferral program. Are you seeing that? And if you are, what do you think of it?
Co-Chair Senator Burdick, indeed, some of the options that foreclosure prevention counselors discuss with homeowners is precisely a reverse mortgage or a property tax deferral. Usually, a property tax deferral will be discussed with a homeowner if, for some reason, the borrower cannot secure a loan modification, for example. So that will be an option. Again, we included this information on the foreclosure brochure.
But my question, to follow up, Mr. Chair, my question is, are the reverse mortgage people encouraging people to get on both programs? In other words, get the property tax deferral and get a reverse mortgage. That's what we're trying to get at.
So, Senator Burdick, your question
is whether mortgage brokers or loan originators are encouraging consumers.
I don't think there will be a discussion since the council in itself is between the counselor, the HECM counselor, and the borrower. So the counselor will discuss all of the options available to the homeowner prior to obtaining the reverse mortgage.
Yeah. Senator Burdick, I'm not sure we actually have enough information to be able to answer that question. I mean, we do get calls periodically, but I don't think in terms of a pattern in practice of folks encouraging both the property tax deferral and a reverse mortgage. I'm not sure that we have enough information to answer that one.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Telfer.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. The loan-to-value is fixed at a specific point in time. And so when you have that 30-35% equity on your property, that can change, as we've seen in this real estate market. So my caution would be, just because at that point in time when that appraisal was done and that loan was made, there was 30-35% potential equity remaining in the house. In this market in Oregon, much of that has been lost, and you can ask any even regular conventional mortgage holder that their house is upside down. Their house, that point in time, had enough equity, but now it's the opposite. So that's true with a reverse mortgage also, in that if somebody got a reverse mortgage in 2005, thinking they had 30-35% equity remaining, that's possibly and probably upside down now. And does a reverse mortgage ever revisit that?
Co-Chair Senator Telfer, what we have seen in terms of depreciation values, indeed, we receive phone calls from people discussing other options such as the property tax deferral program. We have to remember that one of the factors that is used to be able to determine eligibility, or at least the amount, is not only the appraised value, but also other factors such as the age of the homeowner, the interest rate, factors that will actually help the lender make a proper decision as to terms of risk factor.
A follow-up question?
Yes, please.
Well, and I appreciate those, but our concern is that remaining equity upon which the state has some security for any property taxes that we advance to a county on behalf of that property. My understanding is that before somebody gets a reverse mortgage, all liens have to be paid. So if, in fact, they're under the program and there is a lien from the state, that would have to be paid prior to getting a reverse mortgage. Is that... You said all liens had to be paid.
All liens had
to be paid. So that would wipe the slate clean. The state would be reimbursed for all the taxes that they had advanced to counties. So now they're in a reverse mortgage at a point in time when the loan-to-value was established that there was some equity. There may not and probably not any equity left in the home now.
Correct. Representative Berger.
Yes, if you'd indulge me a moment, Mr. Chair, to clarify what she just said. In order to get the original reverse mortgage, they would have had to pay off any existing
lien.
Any existing lien, including the previous property tax deferral?
Again, one of the factors, Coach Senator Berger, one of the factors is that to determine eligibility and the amount is that it is a proper calculation between the value of the home versus any liens available. So there should be no liens whatsoever to have a proper calculation of the amount to be awarded to the borrower. In other words, that even if it's a property tax deferral or anything that is a lien in the property, should be paid off. And it can
be, should be paid off,
should
but
be paid off.
Is it paid off?
I don't have the answer for that, Senator Berger.
And so no one has tracked that. In other words, you have no way of knowing if it was paid off in any reverse mortgage or if it was even I mean, this is a transaction between the mortgagee and the mortgager, and you don't know whether it was paid off. You just have something in there that says you should. Am I correct in that?
Senator Berger, what the lender will do before they can endorse the loan to the Housing and Urban Development, it will be required that there are absolutely no liens that will diminish the ability of the lender to collect any liens if they become due and payable.
They go through a standard closing process, don't they?
Correct.
So there will be a title report.
There will be a title report.
That would contain all the possible liens.
Correct.
And the bank would then require that those liens be paid in the closing as part of making the loan.
That is correct. In fact, one of the things that can be paid off will be if there, for example, a property tax is due around the time when the loan is closed, that will have to be paid off before and it can be portion of the disbursement of the amount of the reverse mortgage can be used to pay off the amount due on the property taxes.
Mr. Chair, doesn't our program say that upon refinancing, our taxes get paid? Our lien gets paid. Isn't that in the program?
I think we're going to have to hear from DOR on that.
I think
it says that upon refinancing, for any reason, whether it be the sale of a house or refinancing, the state's lien for the senior deferral program has to be paid. So it would have to be paid anyway. But I'm also hearing that it gets paid with a reverse mortgage, establishing a reverse mortgage anyway.
Correct.
But Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Burton.
Yes. To these two comments, if that's true, then who are all these people calling us?
With
both reverse mortgages and property tax deferral.
The simple answer to that is that the reverse mortgage is the senior lien.
Correct.
And if we make a loan to pay property taxes, that becomes a junior lien. The bank doesn't care about that because they get paid first. Have I got that?
Correct.
I'm getting head nods.
And so what you just said about assuming that the property tax deferral would have to be paid off is not really true because it's a junior lien.
They're talking about the senior lien when the property tax deferral loan was made before the reverse mortgage was entered in the deed records.
Right. Yes.
At that point, the property tax loan lien is first because it's earlier. So they pay that one off. Then if we make a new loan, that becomes junior because it goes into the deed records later. Have I got that correct?
No, that's correct.
I mean, it's been a long time since I practiced law, but I don't think that rule has changed.
No, that's...
I guess I just didn't understand that it was a matter of timing.
It is.
So if you have the property... If you're on property tax deferral, you have to pay it off before you get a reverse mortgage. But if you have a reverse mortgage, you can subsequently get a property tax deferral because it's junior.
Correct. Except that our statute now says we don't do that.
Right. Correct.
We have two others who've been patiently waiting to get a different questions in. Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to drill down a bit on the equity allowance. You had stated, first I'm seeing a couple of things that I think are not in opposition to each other. You said the maximum loan is the lesser of the appraised value or what the counties have for their limit currently at $625,500. So you also then said that 61% is approximately what's really happening out there on the market for a loan-to-value ratio. So I want to drill down. Is that the 61% cash going to the borrower, leaving the remaining 39% for accrued interest that remains unpaid until disposition or refinancing of the property?
Co-chairs, Representative Brewer, that is correct. In other words, that the calculation for the amount that the borrower will receive, whether in a lump sum or on a monthly installments, will be based on that risk factor that the lender is determining is acceptable to for endorsement to the Housing and Urban Development.
also a follow-up on that, then actuarially they're looking at the life expectancy, credit risk, all of that, and they're distributing out 61% cash equity, but that 39% is not sitting there in equity. That 39% is sitting there for an allotment for accrued interest that is expected upon either death or potential sale, which for our purposes gets us back up to 100% is not readily available for repayment of the deferred taxes. And that's what I want to clarify. Are we then tapping into that 100% for both the principal and the accrued interest that is unpaid and exposing us to non-repayment?
Yeah, I'm afraid I will not be able to answer that properly, Representative Brewer.
Christine?
Representative Brewer, one of the results of the research that I did, I calculated what the balance would be, including the principal and interest over time for each individual loan, and found kind of a frequency chart. But yeah, it was the most frequently 60% of the value of the equity of the house was used up with principal and interest by the end of the loan.
Just to clarify, then 60% is all that's being used for principal and accrued interest.
Yes.
Unpaid, leaving 40% available in equity.
Potentially,
but assuming there's no decrease,
mm-hmm,
and that market rate stays. So that 60% lent includes the accrued interest unpaid. That's a very fine point, but essential.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if I may ask another follow-up
Please.
Question. In that 60% frequency then, is that a lump sum or a line of credit typically pulled out? Is there any type of typical? And with that, is there ever a reappraisal done? Is there a certain time period or situation where reappraisal or reevaluation is done?
Representative Brewer, the 60%, if it's a lump sum, obviously that is a predetermined amount that it has to be withdrawn at the time of closing, so there is no further changes on that particular amount. If the borrower wants to refinance, then yeah, they will have to do it, but there will have to be then another appraisal conducted on the property to determine a different amount. If it's an adjustable rate, then that means, or if it's a line of credit rather, that means that, and the reason I can say this is because I also have a line of credit, that it could be easily adjusted based on the lender guidelines, that if my house depreciates in value, then means that I'm going to have less amount on the line of credit available to me.
So do you have any data about frequency of lump sum versus line of credit?
Unfortunately, I don't, Representative
Okay.
Brewer.
Thank you.
Representative Wan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
We'll keep it fairly brief. We're going to hear from the department, from the LRO as well, and some of the questions that we have may be answered. We have 16 minutes. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm just wondering if you guys have access to a garden variety reverse mortgage document, both loan documents and also the deed of trust or other instrument that gets recorded with the real property records, so I can take a look at it.
Co-chairs, Representative Wan, we probably could get you something that doesn't have any names on it, doesn't have any information on it. On the other hand, you could also get it from probably the Mortgage Lending Association as well, and they probably have a kind of a whole, you know, variety of documents, but we could certainly try to get that for you.
We'll ask LRO to
thank you.
Get
yeah.
that for us.
Because I really don't feel like I'm doing anything worthwhile unless I read a 50-page loan document at any point type.
What I'd like to do now is move to the LRO report, and some of the questions you have may be answered
thank you.
By that. And if you'll just stay right where you are, and when that report is finished, there may be some additional questions for you. Christine?
Talking to me.
Mr. Chair, co-chairs, members of the committee, I just wanted to present quickly a review of the data that were found on the reverse mortgages. I had access to a data set of the home equity conversion mortgages that were federally insured, and so from that I was able to glean a couple of facts and figures from that. But I just want to go over quickly, and this has been covered, that there are different types of reverse mortgages. The federally insured home equity conversion mortgages, or HECMs, are the most common type of reverse mortgage. There's some other private types of mortgages on the market, but they're not as common. There are five different plans that homeowners can choose from to receive their payments, and they can adjust between these at any time. They would be options for having the payments over a term. So if the borrower defined, I wanted to receive my payments over a period of 10 years, they would pull the payments up over 10 years. There's also an option based on the just actuarial expectancies for 10-year option. For as long as they're in the home, they would receive a fixed payment, and there are formulas for that are determined. There's also a potential for a line of credit to receive a portion of your principal as a lump sum at any given time. And then there's two combinations that could happen where the lump sum is combined over time or over a defined period of time or over the borrower's time in the house. And the most common type are the home equity conversion mortgages. The funds are available up front on a formula that's based on age, interest rate, and the maximum claim amount. And as we have mentioned, the maximum claim amount would be the lesser of the appraised value of the property or the area limit of $625,500, which applies for all counties in Oregon. The principal limit also includes any amounts that are financed for closing costs or fees. So the principal limit plus the interest over time would equal the maximum claim amount in theory, but in practice they often don't reach that full amount of equity in the house. So I use a data set from reverse mortgages. Approximately 130,000 mortgages nationwide were terminated, and so I looked at their life cycle and I estimated the amount that the lien would be based on the initial interest rate and the amounts that were borrowed in each policy year. And so I went through the life of the loan and figured out the balance on that loan. Also looked at the property value at closing. I adjusted the starting value of the property by the National Housing Price Index to sort of simulate what would happen to the market over the time.
Mr. Chair, your data set, if you don't, is it an Oregon data set or a national data set?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, Madam Co-Chair, it is a national data set.
Thank you. You don't have available an Oregon data set?
I potentially could filter for that, I believe, based on addresses.
Okay, thank you.
But I'd have to explore. I was wanting to get a large enough data set to have better statistics on it.
I understand. Go on. I didn't mean to interrupt.
It's okay. And ultimately, those two numbers are meant to answer the question, how much equity is left over after that first position HECM loan is satisfied? So, potentially how much could the Department of Revenue be able to recover to the Senior Deferral Program? And this ratio, I calculated this in a ratio. So example one would be when the ratio is less than one. That would be desirable. We want this ratio as low as possible. That's where the reverse mortgage lien is smaller than the home value. Any ratio greater than one would be when the lien is larger than the home value, and that would mean that there was nothing recoverable for the Department of Revenue and the program. So I calculated the statistic for all of the the terminated mortgages over time. And so this is sort of, as you can see, the frequency of when different statistics happen. You know, and as they said, 0.6 was the most common occurrence when 60% of the value of that property is used up by the reverse mortgage, as well as the interest over time and the balance. And then there's a smaller number of ones that are 0.7, 0.8, and 0.9. And as you can see, it's very rare that the reverse mortgage will use up more than 100% of the value. And so that's there's a number of also that are below that 0.6 number. But the most common type is right in the middle there, and that's on the y-axis there. There's the number of reverse mortgages. And there are a couple of risks to this. One would be that this data set does represent the majority of reverse mortgages on the market, approximately 90%. But that was a little bit old that I read that statistic. It was probably about from a 2006 publication, but it should still hold. And some of the private market would be jumbo loans, where the person's property is actually worth more than that $625,000 limit, and that would be a case where the individual could get more money than that limit. But obviously, those people wouldn't really be part of the senior property tax deferral program now, due to the limits on real market value. So that's not really a concern. But one point that I wanted to make was that the reverse mortgages don't necessarily disqualify homeowners from taking out a loan after the reverse mortgage is taken out, but that it would have to be a second position loan. So it's potentially they could have a home equity loan if that lender was willing to take second position to the existing home equity conversion mortgage. Also, declining home value, as we've mentioned, is a huge risk. I mean, that would affect the percentage of the value that's taken up over time. We can see that there's a projection of the Oregon House Price Index done by the Office of Economic Analysis that shows that there's a rebound expected, but 2012 is projected to continue to decline, and then there's a lot of uncertainty as in any projection, you know, whether that rebound would really happen. So that's the change over time, and the actual data go here up to 2011, and then past 2011 there's a projection of the growth of housing values. But this is...
Could you tell us what the index means? Is 400 means it's worth four times the amount that it was in 1989? Or does it mean something different?
Chair Barnhart, that's correct, that it would be four times the amount.
Okay.
It's similar to...
And this is unadjusted dollars.
Well, it's adjusted to be an index, and it's normalized to 100... probably at a point around 1988 or so.
Thank you.
And if it increases by 5%, the typical house in the market would have also increased by 5%, and vice versa. So this is one that had an available projection to it, so we chose that one. But it's uncertain whether that rebound would happen, truly.
And where did the projection of the recovery come from?
Chair Barnhart, the Office of Economic Analysis has made that projection. So one idea for future research that we might want to look into would be to examine trends over time in that proportion of equity taken by a reverse mortgage lien. So, for example, I could take the data that are existing and look at the loans terminating in 2011 and compare them to previous years and see whether there's a trend where maybe more than 60% of the value or more than 60% of the value has been taken up in the most recent loans due to those declining home prices. That might be one idea to see kind of how that's going over time. And, of course, any economist PowerPoint has to have a kayaker on a waterfall. Tradition.
Thank you very much. Representative Brewer and then Senator Telfer.
Thank you. Okay, so a follow-up based on the information you've provided. Christine, you said that the homeowner can adjust between the various options in a reverse mortgage at any time. One is, am I right in that understanding? But two, if then the average ratio is the large proportion are at 0.8 and better for our purposes, if they can adjust, could a reverse mortgage borrower then simply go to a line of credit to pay their property tax deferral? I mean, can they adjust and can they do that so that we put the they have access then to the equity and takes the burden off of the taxpayers underwriting the deferred property tax back to the lender and the borrower on the reverse mortgage underwriting it. If your data is accurate, then there seems to be room for holders of reverse mortgages to tap into that. Am I right in my assumption they can adjust back and forth?
And that may be for the department.
Mm-hmm. So, Representative Brewer, and again, for purposes of calculating how much a borrower or homeowner will be able to qualify, that is already predetermined at the time that the appraisal and the evaluation of the loan application has been taken. So if a borrower on a $200,000 house qualifies for a $100,000 loan, that means that is the maximum amount that borrower will be entitled to. If it's a lump sum, that is the amount that's going to be disbursed at the time of closing. If it's a line of credit, and let's say the borrower only used $20,000, so there is a remaining $80,000 that the borrower can either get that money on a monthly installments or a lump sum. In essence, the remaining $80,000 will be available to the borrower for purposes that they are wanting to use those funds for.
So to clarify, they can't. Thank you, Mr. Chair. They can't toggle back and forth then. So they can't start out at a fixed. I guess then, by Christine's statement that it's adjustable at any time for the five different plans, they either have a fixed, or they have a lump sum, or they have both at the outset. But it's known at the outset, and they can't switch back and forth.
Correct.
They're stuck. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Telfer.
Two questions for clarifications. Christine, you said you mentioned that somebody with a reverse mortgage could possibly apply also for a second mortgage. But that's true for anybody that we're dealing with in the program that has a conventional loan mortgage could also get a line of credit or second mortgage on their home. So that's not unique to somebody with a reverse mortgage. I mean, our equity position or our secure position in the remaining equity would still be questioned with either.
Correct, yes, it's just a risk.
And then the other question I have, and I'm not sure you can answer this, I really think the others can. So point of clarification, the people who have applied for this program with reverse mortgages that under the new law have just been denied can do this in three ways. One is they were in the program before with a reverse mortgage and they now no longer qualify. They could have had a reverse mortgage or they could have had a conventional they could have had a reverse mortgage and wanted to refinance for some reason or another under lower rates or whatever, paid off the lien that the state had for the property taxes and got a new mortgage. Or they could, so it's either they had a reverse mortgage or that they got into the program brand new with a new reverse mortgage and they're in the program new, or they were in the program, paid off the lien with a new reverse mortgage. Meaning they were in the program before, but the lien would have gotten paid.
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, do we have some data on how many of these devices are actually paid off as opposed to forcing the sale of the house to pay them off?
Representative Benz, just make sure, making sure I understand your question. Are you saying the devices you're referring to the reverse mortgages in itself?
Of
course. I do not have that data, but I'm sure we will be able, we could obtain that those figures.
Please.
Right. It seems to me that the way these things generally work is folks draw all the money out one way or the other and then leave the lender with the house. And then a foreclosure occurs, and that's anticipated by virtue of the spread between the amount lent and the value of the house. And in a falling market, it would seem to me that the proportion of loans paid back would be extraordinarily small. But it would be of great interest to see that data.
Correct. So, in essence, Representative Benz, in essence, the loan has to be paid off following, for example, some of the reasons would be that the borrower did not pay property taxes. That would be one way. The other one, when the homeowner no longer occupies the property as a primary residence. So there could be other reasons other than the homeowner not living on the property, as a, using the property as a primary residence. So at that point, the loan becomes due and payable. And obviously, the loan is being paid off. That, but as I mentioned on my statement earlier, the homeowner or the estate will never owe more than the value. In other words, it is a non-recourse loan where the excess owed to the bank will not be responsibility of the homeowner or the estate.
I understand that part of it. I just another question to Christine, and it has to do with the statute itself, 311.684, which says that our lien, the state's lien, is inferior to certain mortgages, and there's a time element. In other words, it says the lien will be is just like all other property tax liens, which means it's first, except as to certain mortgages, and. It would be of interest to know exactly what those mortgages are because I can't tell from the language of the statute, which I'm assuming that somehow all of these reverse mortgages don't fall within the automatic priority arrangement the statute suggests, and instead everything would have to be paid off, as everyone's been discussing, when you enter into the new reverse mortgage, and then we would be looking at it, the state's exposure looking forward after that we've been brought current at the time of the initiation of the reverse mortgage. I just want to make sure my understanding on that is right, and I can take that answer later.
Yeah, why don't we do that in the interest of time?
Yes.
Representative Berger.
Yes, and I will present sort of what I'm trying to get at here, and hopefully more information forthcoming. What I'm trying to get at here, now that I understand sort of how these things work, is how many in Oregon have been issued in the last few years? What I don't get from this data, and also your data set is national and 90% are this HECM loans. What about the other 10%, and is Oregon, that outlier that has 30% non-HECM, and do we have no data on those, and who's issuing them, and what their parameters are? I'm trying really hard to get a scope of the problem that we have in Oregon, numbers and age of these reverse mortgages. If it was just issued in the last 2 years and all, then the liability of the state on the taxes isn't as high as if it was a 5-year reverse mortgage. And do you understand what I'm getting at here? And you don't have to answer these questions now, but this is the data I'm trying to get at to help me evaluate how big our exposure is on this.
Yeah.
In terms of time, the value of houses, which is dropping like a stone, and going forward, and then the individuals who are caught up in this. So that's really helpful to me. Time element is not in here that's helping me. Numbers of reverse mortgages over the last couple of years.
We're really out of time.
Yeah, I just want to say we will try to get you that information. The information that we gave you on the HECM mortgages, we gave those to you because it's also the primary vehicle right now.
Okay.
I mean, the private market is sort of out of it now, but your question is, what was it in the last 5 years?
Right. Yeah, I would simply reinforce that issue. Our task between now and February is to determine whether or not, I think our task is to determine whether or not it's possible for us to make any change in the absolute prohibition of a loan, a property tax loan, in the situation in which there's a reverse mortgage. And in order to get to that, we have to know how much it might cost us, what equity is likely to be left in a house at the end of the sale, so that after the reverse mortgage is paid, so that the state trust fund can be repaid. And that's the essence, I think, of the last several comments, and certainly the ones that interest me. The question I have today is, will you talk about this insured mortgage? What's insured? What is it that the government is agreeing to pay under and for what?
So FHF, the Federal Housing Administration, insures loans that are originated by FHA loan-approved lenders. And if, in essence, the mortgage insurance, because there is a mortgage insurance paid, carries the risk of a default.
So the bank will be reimbursed by FHA?
Correct.
If the house doesn't repay the mortgage?
Yes, that is correct, Representative Barnhart.
I just want to make one final comment. We've been receiving a lot of concerned and reasonably concerned comments from people who have based their financial decisions on being able to get a reverse mortgage and have the state pay for or advance the property taxes than to be reimbursed later. That worked just fine from the 70s until 2005. And the reason it did was because of the rapid run-up in housing prices during that period of time. If you look at the long-term trend in housing prices from the 1890s to today, you can see that there's a huge bump in housing prices during the latter part of that period. Even if a house was underwater in 1990, one could expect that the natural expected increase in the value of the house would cure the problem in a few years for the mortgagee and for the state for the purpose of the loan. We are in a completely different environment now. The environment now is more, if I would say, a return to normal. That's why I challenge the idea that we have, that we're going to get this big increase in real estate values. I doubt that that's actually going to happen, despite the state economists' argument that it will. During this whole period, from 1890 to about 1970, there was no real increase in housing values. There was a change based on inflation, but no real increase in housing values for that long period of time. I think we're returning to normal. And normal is no increase in housing values except for inflation. In other words, a nominal increase, but no real increase. If that's true, then we have to be very careful how we make loans for property tax deferral, which is the reason why the bill that we actually passed contained this prohibition on additional loans to those with reverse mortgages. Now, I would love to be proved wrong about that. I would love for you to be able to present us with data that shows that we can relax that restriction, because some of the people who are in that situation right now where they counted on that loan are in trouble. The fact is, though, we have managed to save this program for at least a plurality, and I think a majority of those who had these kinds of tax loans from us, with the bill we actually did pass. If we can get data that allows us to reduce those restrictions some, I'd like to have it. I also like to have the data if we can't, because I think while at the same time we have eliminated some apparently larger number of people than we thought from being able to receive these loans, we have also protected the capacity of a number of people to continue to receive these loans and continue to live in their houses. And just to kind of wrap up, we have, we're in the process of borrowing a $19 million to keep that trust fund solvent over the next several years in the hopes that we can bring it back up to a cash flow balance in that time. So that's where I think Representative Berger's questions come from, and certainly where my questions come from. And I think that's the challenge the committee and the legislature is going to have in February.
Co-chair Barnard, I just I want to manage our expectations on this. This data is not something that we usually collect. We will do our best to get it. Otherwise, we would have had it to you today. But we will do our best to get that.
Thank you. We really appreciate your help. Very much. And I think that with that, we need to move on.
Mr. Chair, yes. Can I just ask, because I think the last meeting, we also had a question regarding the default by not paying their property taxes November 15th, and we were looking for a solution or a legislative option. I was kind of hoping to hear that today.
I think the answer to that, because these things don't move at lightning speed, if we have a solution for February, We'll write a special exception into the statute for that to cover the period from November 15th to the time that the new law goes into effect.
Can that tell a mortgage holder that their loan is not in default? A mortgagee's loan is not in default because we can't go against the contract. The contract says
true.
If you don't pay your taxes November 15th, you're in default, and things. All kinds of things.
A comment on that?
So we're not getting any input or answer to that today. Okay.
We don't know, but that's a good question. Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate this is a tough issue for us, and we appreciate your input. Highway Fund Revenue Update, Department of Transportation. Okay.
Gentlemen, Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, and Chair Berger, for the record, Clyde Steike, Deputy for Central Services for the Oregon Department of Transportation. With me at the table are Travis Brower, our Federal Affairs Advisor, and Dave Kavanaugh, who's the State Transportation Economist. And we're here today to give you a update on the Highway Revenue Fund. The items we're going to be covering for the committee today are on the second slide of the handout. We'll talk a little bit about the federal transportation funding and then move on to the other topics, which will be covered by Mr. Kavanaugh. So since we have a lot to cover, let's get right into it, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Brower.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Travis Brower. I'm ODOT's Federal Affairs Advisor. Within ODOT, I'm often known as a little bit of a little black rain cloud for my gloomy projections of what could be coming at us from the federal level. Today, since we've got a nice sunny autumn day, I think I'll try to inject a little bit of a ray of sunshine at the end after pelting you with a little bit of a shower. For context, the Highway Trust Fund is very important for the state of Oregon. Annually, this is the Federal Highway Trust Fund, annually it provides about $500 million in investment in highway and transit projects throughout the state. Most of the revenue that flows into the Federal Highway Trust Fund comes from the federal fuels taxes, as well as a few federal excise taxes on trucks. The federal fuels tax, though, has not been raised since 1993, so revenue has not really grown apace with the funding levels that Congress has approved for the surface transportation program. And since the advent of high gas prices back a few years ago and the Great Recession, revenue into the Federal Highway Trust Fund has fallen by about 10%, which is about close to $4 billion on an annual basis. Congress has raised spending on highways and transit over the last 18 years since they last raised the gas tax, but the funding levels have been essentially flat since 2007. However, at this point, and you can see this on the first graph included in our PowerPoint, the funding levels that Congress is approving on an annual basis are about $15 billion higher than the revenue flowing into the Highway Trust Fund. Even in Washington, D.C., $15 billion is still real money. They could do that because the Highway Trust Fund had substantial balances. It's much like the Social Security Trust Fund, where money has been flowing in for years and spending has been lower than the revenue coming in. But that has now reversed in the Highway Trust Fund, much as it will in the Social Security Trust Fund in the long term. The imbalance between spending and revenue has led the Highway Trust Fund to burn through its balances, burn through its reserves. And since 1998, the first time that the trust fund burned through its reserves, Congress has had to transfer funding into the Highway Trust Fund to keep funding from falling substantially. They have done three infusions of general fund resources into the Highway Trust Fund since 2008, totaling about $35 billion. As a result of that, we now have balances that, as you can see on this chart, will last through hopefully the end of federal fiscal year 2012, maybe into early 2013. Since the federal fiscal year starts on October 1st, we're talking, you know, about a year from now, maybe a little bit more. When those balances are exhausted in the highway account and the mass transit account, Congress will have a very difficult choice to make. They will either have to cut funding by about a third, funding that flows out to states, local governments, and transit providers, or they will have to find additional revenue to cover that deficit once again. That is about, as I said, about $15 billion a year, so they could transfer that amount of money in from the general fund, or they could increase user fees. The federal gas tax is currently about 18.3 cents per gallon. They would need about a 10 cent per gallon increase in the federal gas tax to cover that amount. As you can imagine, in Washington, D.C. right now, there's some differences of opinion on how this should be solved. In the House of Representatives, the appropriations and authorization legislation that is moving forward would impose a funding cut of about one-third. The next chart in the PowerPoint shows you what that looks like. In 2011, our current fiscal year, we got about $479 million from the federal government. Under the Surface Transportation Authorization proposal put forward by Chairman John Mica in the House, he's the chair of the Transportation Infrastructure Committee, and also under the House Transportation Appropriations bills, that funding would be cut by about a third, and Oregon's funding would fall somewhere in the range of $150, $175 million. Our best guess estimate is we'd get about $316 million next year. Luckily, we anticipated the potential federal cuts when we developed the current surface or statewide transportation improvement program, because we saw the long-term financial challenges facing the trust fund, and we assumed a federal funding cut of about 20%. Obviously, 20% is less than 33%. So if they were to cut funding to the level supported by revenue flowing into the trust fund, ODOT would still be short by about $70 million a year. So we would have to further delay or cut projects below beyond the cuts we have already made in the STIP, which are pretty substantial. There would also be an impact to local governments. Each year, local governments get about a quarter of the federal highway funding flowing to ODOT. That is in the range of $100 to $130 million a year. And if there was a funding cut of a third, that would be about a $30 to $40 million hit for local governments. Transit programs could be very hard hit because of the way the mass transit account of the Highway Trust Fund is funded. It's about 40% short. And so we could see a 40% cut flow down to transit providers throughout the state. This would significantly impact the ability of transit providers to make capital investments like bus purchases, and would be likely to hit small town and rural areas particularly hard, as they use a portion of that federal funding for operations costs as well. You've probably heard the president talk a bit about his American Jobs Act, a proposal that would infuse about $50 billion into surface transportation programs in the next year. I'm not particularly optimistic that that will pass, given the discussion in Washington, D.C. right now. However, I think the pivot of Congress from focusing almost entirely on deficit reduction this summer to now this focus on jobs and economic recovery will make it more likely that Congress will not cut transportation funding in the upcoming fiscal year. The little bits of intelligence flowing down from Washington, D.C. indicate that there is hopefully going to be some sort of bipartisan agreement to keep funding at current levels. However, that doesn't address the long-term fiscal challenges of the Highway Trust Fund. It would just be a one-year patch.
So, Chair Barnhart, if anybody has any questions, we can take them on the federal issue on this time, and then
Given our time situation, I'd prefer to go ahead, finish your report, and then ask for questions.
Great.
Over the whole thing.
Sure. So, Mr. Kavanaugh will now talk about the state highway.
Great. Thank you. Fine.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, co-chairs, and members of the interim panel on revenue. For the record, my name is Dave Kavanaugh, the Oregon Department of Transportation's state transportation economist. I'm going to present the other fund's revenue forecast, which is what we provide to DAS that gives a report to the legislature on December 1st and June 1st of every year. And so the numbers that I'm going to be talking about today will be repeated again in that report of the other fund's forecast, which includes a number of other agencies, Education Department, Employment Department, et cetera. The total revenues that are in that report on a biennium basis run at around $2.3 to $2.4 billion. Now, these are revenues that are just collected within the state gas taxes and vehicle and driver's fees. It doesn't include a forecast for local option taxes or vehicle registration fees, and nor does it incorporate the federal funding outlook that Mr. Brower just reviewed for you. The forecast is stated in very aggregate terms in terms of gross revenues, and I always take pains, as an aside, this is page 3 of the handout. The department didn't intend to rearrange the real line in going from slides 12 to 13 to 3, but it is now the pagination is number 3. Just thought I'd point that out to eliminate the confusion. In order to get to the net revenues or the resources that are available to the department for the construction and maintenance programs, we go ahead and deduct dedicated program transfers. We deduct collection costs and program costs. And we also deduct interagency transfers for programs like the ATV programs with parks and fuel tax transfers for the Marine Board for marine use of gasoline, taxable gasoline. Those are all taken out to come up with a number trying to get as close to what discretionary resources we actually have in the agency. Collateral, so that leaves, once we're done with those deductions, that leaves about 1.7 per biennium. Then we also go ahead and share with our local governments and stakeholders an apportionment of the highway fund, as you know. And once we do that, the counties on a biennium basis get around $450 to $500 million a biennium. And the cities receive about $300 to $325 million. So when it's all said and done, the amount of resources that are net revenues to the agency amount to about $900 million per biennium. What are the assumptions? This forecast is aligned with the May close of session forecast from the Office of Economic Analysis and the attendant macroeconomic outlook that drove that forecast. Turning to slide 4, what comprises the forecast? There are two ways of kind of looking at how we get revenues. One is by source. There's the motor fuel tax revenues, which is by far and away the largest one at about $1.02 billion, again on a gross basis. Weight mile taxes, which are the taxes paid by heavy trucks in excess of 26,000 pounds in lieu of them paying a diesel fuel tax. Vehicle and license fees are the next category. That includes light vehicle registrations and renewals, as well as heavy trucks, trailers, if you will, all the registration that goes with vehicles. Driver's license fees is a fairly small sliver, and that also includes driver's license renewals. And then the other component are other licenses and fees. That relates to vehicle titles. On purchasing a new vehicle, you'd pay for a title, but it also accounts for title transfers. And also other compliance or regulatory things, such as business regulation that regulates dealer certificates. Another way of classifying the revenues is how it varies by usage or just by no usage on the system. The user taxes, which are the fuel taxes and the weight mile taxes, those revenues vary by how intensively the system is used. Okay. The other component, vehicle and driver and other fees, those are viewed more like an admission fee. Those don't vary by how much the system is actually used. They're just the price of admission. But we go ahead, as the intensity increases, then we would go ahead and get more user tax revenues. How are we doing on tracking the revenue forecast? Page 5. What I've done is kind of juxtaposed two prior forecasts with our current forecast, and to try to just offer a little bit of a comparative backdrop between them. We talk about the December 2009 forecast and the December 2010 forecast, our most recent one, prior to the one that we just released in late August. In 2009, we were still kind of in the throes of the Great Recession, if you will, and so the forecast then didn't really have a full appreciation of how deep the recession was going to be. So there, we actually wound up seeing that there was a real broad erosion of revenues across all revenue classes, user tax revenues, as well as what are usually more stable because they're related to demographic characteristics, the vehicle fees and driver's fees. They were also very weak. In the 11-13 biennium, the 2009 forecast still looked for a considerable erosion of about minus 4% in the outlook, because by that time it was becoming very clear that the downturn was going to be far more serious than what had been pegged back in the 2008-2009 time frame. Since then, the 2010 forecast, the in terms of tracking, we're missing the user tax revenues still a little bit, not quite as badly as we were in 2009, but the vehicle fees and driver fees aren't missing by quite as much. So the stable demographics are kind of bolstering that, but we're still somewhat sensitive to how intensively the system or the network is being used. Going forward into 2013, the forecast is still for there to be a little bit of erosion, notwithstanding the fact that we passed the Jobs and Transportation Act legislation that act as a real bump to the revenue collections. A forecast summation is presented on slide 6. Although the scale of the chart kind of belies how big of a downturn we had in transportation revenues, you can see in 2009 the economic contractions had quite an impact nevertheless. Going forward, what we've done here is the blue line is what we were forecasting in December 2008 prior to JTA. So this gives us the benchmark from which we can go ahead and assess the incremental impact from JTA taxes and fee increase or revenue enhancements. JTA itself is in the red line there, and you can see that the recession causes a little bit of a blip on that green line. Then in 2010, 2011, and 2012, revenues ramp up because of JTA. At the end of 2012, we're back to a steady state, so then the growth rate kind of levels out at slightly above 2% a year, which unfortunately is still only at the rate of construction cost escalation.
Just as clarification, JTA is House Bill 2001?
Yes.
Okay.
Some of us remember it.
Yeah. I'm acronym averse, so I don't remember any of these things if they're not spelled out. Thank you. Were you finished?
I had just one more.
Please, go ahead.
One more slide on the revenue forecast. I have a few other topics. That
great, go ahead, yes.
Risk for the outlook, like any good forecast, we always want to have some wiggle room and throw out some caveats. Unfortunately, they're not very encouraging. The big issue is how is the rate of recovery going to be going forward, and so far it's been stalling out a little bit, so that's not very good. The global economic backdrop and financial backdrop is the big hang-up, and to say that is an understatement. But the sovereign debt crisis, for example, it seems to have creating quite a bit of paralysis. When we first started doing the forecasts after the Jobs and Transportation Act legislation, it looked like the odds of a double-dip recession were being stated at about 1 out of 6, 1 out of 5, so to speak. Then a year later, they all of a sudden they went to 1 out of 4, and now they're down to 1 out of 3, 1 out of 2. And indeed, it might even be a coin toss where it might be 51% no double dip, 49% a double dip. So with that in mind, the odds are kind of going in the wrong direction. We're going to go ahead and rerun the model under a pessimistic scenario just to see what is going to be a bare bones amount of resources available to the construction and maintenance programs of the agency. So that hopefully will be done the latter part of this month. It'll be a very abridged report, but again, I feel it's incumbent upon us to go ahead and examine a pessimistic scenario. So we're using the most pessimistic macro backdrop that's currently available, coupled with what's reported in the September state economic forecast from the Office of Economic Analysis. I'd be happy to answer any questions on the state revenue forecast, or else I'll go on to another topic.
Representative Berger.
Just a quick question on page 3, which is up to page 13, Mr. Kavanaugh, which is your opening page. You had dedicated program fund transfers as a subtraction out. Would you give me an example of that?
Yes, there are some uses of gasoline that are non-highway. What we call the lawnmower fund or small equipment uses. Those monies don't go into the highway fund. They're subtracted out and go into the transportation operating fund.
Yeah, but that...
And then those monies then go to...
interagency transfers?
Representative Berger, those...
What I'm looking at is from 2.3 to 2.4 down to 1.7 billion disappears in 3 bullet points, and that's a lot of money in 3 bullet points, and I'm trying to get at what those bullet funds are.
Well,
and
yes,
track that billions of dollars.
Representative Berger, it's the real big subtraction is represented in collection costs and program costs. The interagency transfers and the dedicated programs.
Those aren't very big. It's all in collections.
Yeah, they're less than 100
million. Thank you. Yes. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Thank you. Why don't you go ahead to your other topic, and we'll ask others to ask the questions on the whole presentation after you're finished.
Yes. On the Jobs and Transportation Act revenue, JTA revenue, slide 9, every quarter we supply the legislature with a detailed component-by-component report on the revenues that are generated by the Jobs and Transportation Act. And collateral with that, we provide a forecast for the current quarter in which the report is being delivered. The last report was delivered to the legislature in the first week in August. The next one is due in the first week in November. How have we been doing on the JTA forecasting? Initially, the revenue impact analysis was to produce about $300 million a year, taking out the Travel Information Council and taking out monies that are apportioned for long-range planning would produce about a net of $300 million. Of course, that's also apportioned with the counties and city governments. In 2009, when the legislation was being crafted, the Legislative Revenue Office forecast about $298 million in FY12 and a little bit more than $300 million in FY13. Our current projection, given the softening of the economic backdrop, both nationally as well as statewide, we're forecasting about $276 million, or about 7% less than we were back in May of 2009. And also, the $300 million threshold, unfortunately, in our current projections, doesn't occur until several years after the 2015 timeframe, which is beyond the forecast horizon of the model. The chart on the next page, number 10, shows a graphic of the differential between what we thought the world was going to look like in FY12 going forward and with where it is today. And unfortunately, it's kind of parametrically lower than what we were expecting, on the order of about 7% or 20-some-odd million dollars. I'll go ahead to the next topic.
Please.
Legislation for transportation revenue from the last regular session, House Bills 5047, 3684, and Senate Bill 442, are all revenue generators that, or detractors as the case may be, that do not go to the highway fund. They're dedicated to other programs. Another example. The first one, 5047, was a bill that prohibited enactment of a fee increase for snow park permits. They can be daily, 3-day, or annual permits. The proposal was for those fees to go up somewhere on the order of 25% to 33%. 5047 revoked that and prohibited those fee increases from going into effect. The result of that was to create a shortfall from the planning purposes of about $627,000. The agency is working with a lot of stakeholders on that to figure out how to fund the snowpark projects, maintenance projects, so to speak, and clearing projects without continual fee increases. And the anticipation is that by February 2012, the stakeholders will pretty well have ironed out how these programs can be supported. House Bills 36 and 84 and Senate Bill 442 are both specialty plate bills. The Keep Kids Safe program, the former one, would increase plate fees on a surcharge basis from $10 to $64 every 2 years, and the net proceeds would go to the Children's Trust Fund of Oregon Foundation. The trust would go ahead and pay for the implementation of the plate program. And then the final one is the Wine Country registration plate with a $30 surcharge for every 2 years, with the net proceeds going to the Oregon Tourism Commission. Both initiatives, the proponents of the initiatives have not supplied the money to actually implement the program yet. And when they do, Department of Motor Vehicles anticipates that it would be about 6 months before the plates would actually be available for sale after that. Okay, finally, moving on, a budget note to the agency's spending limitation in the 2009 session, House Bill 5548-A, directed the Office of Economic Analysis at DAS to do an evaluation of ODOT's revenue forecasting procedures. They hired a contractor to go ahead and look at the framework and the processes that we use to forecast the revenues. Technically, the contractor and the Office of Economic Analysis endorsed said that the process was technically implemented soundly, but there were some recommended strategies to go ahead and improve the process, which the agency has embraced. A couple of these things that we've been doing is to go ahead and give stakeholders a more precise timetable of when the forecast would be available, and if they get a derivative report out of the forecast, to go ahead and give them an indication of when that would be available. And some of these things are things that we collaboratively have been doing with OEA all along anyway, so some of the recommendations were really kind of redundant. There are some that are related to continuous improvements to eliminate the time lag from when the Office of Economic Analysis does their forecast from when we're able to go ahead and take delivery of it. It sounds pretty trivial, but sometimes there can be some snags there that can hold us up a little bit. And then finally, some of the recommendations were a little bit amorphous in terms of concretely putting our finger on them as a resolution, and so I proposed to them that we develop a work group and just kind of work through these things as they come up so that we feel like we're getting a little bit of peer review input into the process to make sure that we're not shortchanging the process. So that's what I have for that particular activity. I'd be happy to answer any additional questions.
So, Chair Barnhart, just to wrap up, one of the greatest risks we face is the uncertainty at this federal level, and so we'll be monitoring that very closely. We are preparing for lower funding levels, both from the federal government and through the state highway fund. We are incorporating that into our planning process, and we also have implemented a workforce reduction plan that looks to reduce our workforce by 5% over the next three to five years. And then depending on some of the decisions we make and some of the decisions that are made at the federal level, we may or will probably see some system condition deterioration just because of the reduced funding levels. And with that, that's our presentation. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, comments? Representative Berger.
Quick comment. Thank you, gentlemen, for this report. It was concise, and it's one of many that we've seen where we have to do more with less, and it's incumbent on the agency, and this is my caution, to be very, very careful with the less you have and spend it to be most effective in terms of our economic development goals. Thank you.
The reduction in the federal funds will lead to a reduction in the size or number of contracts that you put out to private contractors for projects, so, won't it? that reduces the number of jobs that are available in the private sector in Oregon for highway projects. Have I got that?
Yes.
So whether we are able to proceed with economic activity that leads to job growth in Oregon may depend very much on what Congress does with this issue that you've raised today on their transportation trust fund. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. You've indicated a workforce reduction of 3 to 5%. You're talking about in the department.
Chair Barnhart, that's correct. That's the department's workforce.
Now, if I understand what you've said about this other issue correctly, the workforce reduction among the private contractors who work on projects for you might be considerably larger than that, mightn't it?
Potentially, yes, that's true.
Go ahead, please.
I could make one point, though.
Yes, please.
The numbers change with some frequency. When we implemented the 3 to 5% reduction, it was based on numbers we had probably about 6 to 8 months ago.
Yes.
Our financial folks are in the process of rerunning the numbers based on the information we have today. So we'll see what impact that has.
I guess the point I was raising is that there's a certain overhead that you have no choice about maintaining.
That's true.
But when you don't get money from the federal government for a project, you don't do the project.
That's correct.
So that would seem to have a substantial impact. Another question I had that isn't directly related, I think, to this material here, what has happened with the recession in terms of your costs for projects, and what effect has that had on your ability to do the work? I mean, just a general comment. I don't need the detail.
Chair Barnhart, we have seen very good bid prices on capital construction projects over the last few years. Quite a number of our projects have come in at under the engineer's estimate, and that has allowed us to stretch those dollars further. In fact, quite a number of the Jobs and Transportation Act projects that the legislature gave us have come in where we thought there was not enough money in the Jobs and Transportation Act allocation to complete the project, and then the actual bid came in below the amount. For example, the I-5 northbound auxiliary lane that is currently under construction to I-205 in Wilsonville, we thought we had a shortfall of several million dollars, and we're looking for federal funding to fill that gap. That project actually came in at almost exactly the amount allocated in the Jobs and Transportation Act.
So I would also add, Chair Barnhart, that probably over the last 2 years, we've also seen very good prices in terms of materials. We're starting to see that come back up. So we're starting to see a little bit of an upward trend on the costs of material now.
But still lower than they used to be?
Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, it would seem to me that all else being equal, now's the time for Oregon to be doing construction projects. We have people in the construction industry who are out of work. The contractors are willing to work for less money. That would be the time to do it, wouldn't it, if we had the funds available?
I would agree with you, and I would point to last construction season, which my understanding is probably the busiest construction season we've had in the last 50 years, and I think we've been just as aggressive this construction season.
The legislature has done its job, and now it's up to Congress. Yes? Thank you. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that promotion as well. I don't see the Columbia River crossing mentioned in here. Can you just comment briefly on what the impact of all this kind of shrinkage is going to be on that project?
Co-Chair Burdick, it's very difficult to say what the impact will be on any specific project because it's not just the funding level that matters. It's how Congress rewrites the program structure in the long-term surface transportation authorization bill, which they're doing right now. So we'll be watching that very carefully to see what type of programs they write. For example, in the Senate, they're talking about creating a dedicated freight program for routes of national significance, which might benefit the Columbia River Crossing. What we've seen at the federal level is that the Columbia River Crossing housing has been recognized as a top priority by two administrations in a row. Secretary LaHood, the current Secretary of Transportation, has talked about the Columbia River Crossing in multiple hearings as an example of a progressive, forward-looking, important project. He's mentioned on his blog, for example. And just recently, when we applied for federal funding, we received the largest single grant in the nation under the Federal Highway Administration grant programs. So we think it will be competitive for whatever programs Congress makes available.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Wander, very briefly.
Very briefly. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'd be interested to get a quantification of the amount of the reduced costs for your projects for the last couple of years since the beginning of the economic downturn. And then secondly, you're probably going to want to keep a closer eye on change orders and your attorney's budgets when contractors are coming in under the engineer's estimates. Just a little piece of friendly advice.
Spoken as one who might know about that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your presentation. And I, what Representative Wan's suggestion, I think probably Ways and Means Committee would like to know about that, too.
Yeah.
We certainly would. Department of Revenue Audit Follow-Up, Secretary of State, Audit Division. And I'm afraid we're going to short the LRO on the last item. Yeah. Please.
Great. Co-chairs Burdick, Barnhart, Berger. My name is Gary Blackmer. I'm the director of the Secretary of State's Audits Division. With me is Principal Auditor Amy Palacios. She was the lead on this follow-up review that we conducted of the Department of Revenue. And just to give you kind of the basically, we go in after our recommendations have been made to see what actions the agency has undertaken. And this is, we issued the audit in April 2010, and we essentially went back about a year later and started looking at what efforts they'd undertaken. One of our recommendations had kind of a sense of urgency in it, so we wanted to come back relatively quickly and see what had been done. And basically, what we saw was that Department of Revenue had undertaken actions on all of our recommendations, but we also recognized that they were large, ambitious recommendations that they needed to complete and that there's still a lot more that needs to be done. So that would be kind of the quick soundbite summary of it. What we did in the original 2010 audit was look at their filing enforcement activities as well as their collections to determine how well they were doing at those activities. And we found a number of areas where they could improve. One of the major efforts in that audit was we matched the filers of federal tax forms through the IRS with filers of Oregon forms, and we identified what we thought was about 66,000 filers who looked like they should file and actually owed some taxes. We estimated the total amount for tax year 2007 was $109 million. So we, and looking at their collections efforts in the past, they were collecting about half that amount. So we estimated that what could be collected was about $54 million of personal income taxes. So that was one of the biggest areas that we focused on. We also looked at some of their other activities around collections and recommended things like better use of private collection firms for some of the accounts. And so what I'd like to do is kind of go through quickly our recommendations. And our report is very brief. We have a we have a brief little summary, and then for each of the recommendations, we developed a table that essentially summarizes the actions the department's taken. So in the there were three broad areas that we talked about. We felt like they could better identify filers, that there were some things that they could do around performance management, in that they could develop some indicators and measures of performance, productivity, and effectiveness, and also streamline some of their work processes. And then the third area was that notion of urgency, that with that kind of effort out there and the rewards of collecting these uncollected taxes, it would obviously be important to the state. I should point out that that $109 million represents 2% more than they currently collect. So it, in the broadest scheme of things, it's not a huge amount that it's gone uncollected, but in these times, any extra effort and any extra productivity and efficiency is certainly valuable. So what we saw was that the department had updated its filing enforcement strategies, and it was starting to use some sophisticated computer software to identify non-filers, but it was not doing it in a consistent, comprehensive way yet. We looked at the non-filers. They had sent out letters to about 3,800 non-filers that they identified in the 2008 tax year, and about 91% did not follow through in terms of there was no response from those potential filers. The department added those non-filers into its account pool that it works through to identify reasons for not filing, trying to collect taxes. So there was a little bit of an effort in terms of notifying people that they might owe money, but again, that more could be done there. We looked at the timeliness and results goals that could be set up for Department of Revenue personnel, and they started doing that effort, and from our standpoint, that's a good step forward. Some of the problems that they encounter is they really do have a very fragmented computer system that is difficult for them to kind of put those measures together in order to develop a good comprehensive information system. But nonetheless, I think more could be done in a manual way to be able to track in a data warehouse approach to their performance and productivity. One of the good things that they've been doing is they've been looking at all their work processes and looking at opportunities to streamline them. They've been very aggressive in applying lean processes, which is a rapid process improvement strategy, to look at all their activities and look at what they can do to reduce unnecessary steps, to speed up their activities, and to be more timely and effective in their work. Because ultimately, one of the fundamental issues around collections is to act quickly. And so they are looking at ways to respond more quickly when a taxpayer calls in, and also in terms of processing payments and so forth. One of the other areas that we feel like they have done some effort is working with the private collection firms. What they did was an analysis. They developed a sample of accounts that were fresh accounts. In the past, what they had done was waited sometimes up to 2 years to give accounts to a private collection firm to collect on. They developed a sample of fresh cases that they gave to the private collection firms, a sample that they also collected on, and compared the results. Unfortunately, what we saw in that test was that the sample that was drawn was not similar, that the amounts actually in the to be collected on the Department of Revenue side were twice the amounts than what the private collection firms could conceivably collect. And also, there was no tracking of the costs of what they put into the collections relative to the private collection firms. So we felt like they could actually kind of explore doing more. When you have a big bulge in your workload, it makes sense to bring in contractors, temporary type resources to work that bulge down. And if we're trying to work on urgency of collections, that could be one area that they could continue to explore. They've developed skip trace tools, and they've started implementing some semi-automated processes to assign accounts to the private collection firms and reconcile payments. That was one of the other delays. The private collection firms could not close a deal with a taxpayer. They had to go back to Department of Revenue to determine what the actual amount was, because interest rates were accumulated on a daily basis, and only Department of Revenue was able to provide that authorized amount. We recommended that they look at ways to increase their sharing of information with private collection firms. And again, that depends upon their new system that they need to start looking to implement. And in fact, they issued an RFP in June of 2011 for a new system. Unfortunately, the time for implementation, it's likely not to be online for another 5 or 6 years. So from the standpoint of collections and filing enforcement, you know, we think that some efforts can be taken before that system is in place, but they certainly do need to look at some kind of a long-term replacement of it. They have looked at shifting employees toward different workload responsibilities, which is one of the recommendations that we made as well. So that, in a nutshell, is what actions they've taken and the others that are out there to be done. And we're also looking forward to communicating with the new director when that person's appointed and kind of providing insights and providing a briefing on our audit if he or she requests it.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Brewer, I see first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question. A lot of this was focused on collections, so once the assessments happened and the bill is unpaid. But backing up way before that, when you say there's $109 million potentially, and I look at the letters, and 2% were determined not required to file, so 2% of that $109 million goes away, but the remaining is still available. 91% of the letters sent received no response. It seems at that point then nothing's changed.
They did include that into their pool of accounts that they will take collections efforts on. So to the degree that they notified them that they thought they had a requirement to file, they didn't hear a response. So now they have a database of non-filers out there that they're working through.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Brewer, one of the components to consider in that number of the 66,000 that we identified and then the Department of Revenue sort of reran that filter on the 2008 taxpayers are individuals who are required to file who may not have owed a sufficient amount of taxes. And so I think the Department of Revenue in their consideration of what to pursue is weighing that balance, the cost benefit of, you know, trying to track down people to get them to file when they may not owe taxes. You may be required to file an Oregon return if you file a federal return, even though you owe no taxes. So that's kind of factored into those percentages somewhat, even though that $109 million is just the estimate of what might be owed by those taxpayers.
Please.
Thank you. So to follow up then, of the 91% of those letters that have no response and there's a federal filing, do they then go into the just so I understand the process then, do they then go into the potential assessment where the state files a return on their behalf based on the federal information? Could this potentially, this 91%, potentially end up in that pot where we go through and end up with an eventual assessment without a taxpayer voluntarily responding and filing?
Representative Brewer, I believe that that is correct. What they did with those 3,800 or the 91% that did not respond is they put them into their LEADS database where they can identify certain taxpayers who may have a need to file, and then when their agents have time, they go follow up on those LEADS, and that is the point at which I believe they would create a tax return if there's enough information to do so.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've covered how they are dealing with the ones that you identified. What about the ongoing matching of federal returns with state returns? It was unclear to me what the specific recommendation was on that and what they're doing about it.
Co-Chair Burdick, they in 2008 for the filers, they did the same match that we did. So they do have that capability now. It's my understanding that they're going to be doing that on a more routine basis. So that was one of the things that getting this ACL software is a very powerful data analysis and matching software that we routinely use in our audits. They acquired it, and they're getting up to speed with it. There are more opportunities out there, we believe, for them to apply that in other contexts. So there's more to be collected out there. It's a matter of, you know, basically working through our recommendations and then other ones that they see in terms of priorities as well.
Thank you. And Mr. Please. Chair, yep. I can't let this moment pass without reissuing kudos for doing this, because, you know, it was a source of frustration of mine, certainly, and I think it was shared by others, that this wasn't being done a long time ago. And so you kind of, you had the beacon light that caused this to start happening. So I think that that speaks very well. How many, just to refresh my memory, how many auditors did you have working on this?
We had two full-time and doing a lot of the data analysis and observing and working through the process for about a year is what it took ultimately to get to what we felt were some good solid numbers in terms of the number of accounts and the amount that was owed. And we worked closely with Department of Revenue through that process to make sure that our methods were, you know, clear and sensible to them and were kind of basic. They had a good sound basis in the work that they do.
Well, it was a fine piece of work, and I think it will make a difference, a big difference going forward, as well as what you already identified.
Chair Burdick, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your presentation today. I think your report and Senator Burdick's comments support the long-term function of our state constitution in the sense that it assigns this task to the Secretary of State, and as an independent agent, you help us make sure that things are working the way they need to be working, and where they aren't, get them fixed. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Finally, it is 10:30 and time for the corporate minimum tax issues review by the Legislative Revenue Office. Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll ask Chris and Kate to come up because they're working with us on this. I have a one-page handout for you that is just titled Corporate Minimum Tax Issues. Several of these are on your work plan list. Our intent here today, very briefly with you, is to identify these issues, kind of what we know, which is they're in process of being determined. They're essentially legally based issues, and Kate, of course, is helping us work through those. The first one I wanted to identify is around the 2% surplus kicker. And if you've ever, I can recall looking at the actual language in the Constitution about the kicker, is that for the corporate kicker, there is specific language that says this section does not apply to revenues derived from any minimum tax imposed on corporations for the privilege of carrying on or doing business in this state that is imposed as a fixed amount and that is non-apportioned. So if it's a corporate minimum that's imposed on a fixed amount, it is therefore not part of the corporate kicker calculation. So what is the issue revolves around then? What does the fixed amount mean? In our discussions with the Legislative Council, we've interpreted the fixed amount to be a fixed dollar amount for particular taxpayers. And basically what this means is that the corporate minimum, as it was passed and approved by voters in 2010, is not subject to the corporate kicker calculation. So that means that in order to do a close of session estimate, and we've been talking with Office of Economic Analysis about this as well, in order to do a close of session estimate, there should be a separate estimate of that corporate minimum revenue, and then you would go through the comparison at the end of the biennium, what did you actually receive in non-corporate minimum taxes compared to what you projected in non-corporate minimum taxes. So the implications are only that adjustment should be made, and regardless of how it's made, our concern would be not to try to make it or adjust it, you know, toward the end of a biennium when we've got a kicker potentially come up. So our suggestion is that we go ahead and ask the state economist to make a separate calculation of that corporate minimum, and present that in the quarterly forecast. So we'll track it in that way. There are other possible interpretations, however, and we do know that the Attorney General's office has been looking at this as well. We haven't seen anything specific from them, but that would be that does a fixed amount mean simply a fixed dollar amount, like the flat amount which, remember, there's a $150 amount that applies to the smallest corporations, less than $500,000 in sales, and the S corporations. So that would be a more narrow definition. A broader definition would be that everybody has some minimum amount that they pay, and you calculate that, some hypothetical minimum, and then everything above that would be the non-minimum. So that would be the broader interpretation.
Wait, to go back to that, how would that number be determined?
You'd have to determine it based on the return itself. What would be, you'd have to see the minimum as a separate calculation. And let's say you're a corporation that's paying more than the minimum, you'd have some hypothetical minimum amount, and the amount above that would be non-minimum.
Wow.
So my sense is that would be stretching it, but Chris came up with that one, so attribute that to him. Well, he's got quite an imagination.
It is actually a different tax, isn't it? We have an income tax. If you don't have any income, you don't pay it.
Yes.
You pay a corporate minimum tax if you don't pay the income tax.
Yeah. So it's an alternative, yes.
Yeah.
And that, I know that's how the policy discussion evolved, and the first interpretation would be consistent with that. But we've had discussions with Kate, so she's here to answer any questions about council's interpretation of that.
On this point, anything further? Yeah, Senator Burdick.
Yeah, I have
co-chairs are all in now.
I have a question. Is one of these interpretations, maybe I'm still jet lagged here, but that the 150 would count as the flat dollar amount, but the amount that's based on the gross receipts or the gross Oregon sales would not count in this respect. Is that a possible interpretation?
Chair Burdick, Chair Barnhart, Chair Berger, members of the committee, Kate Toswell, Office of Legislative Counsel. As we've already started to hear, the question here is interpreting both primarily the constitutional kicker provision, but then also the statutory kicker. And the language imposed as a fixed amount is in the Constitution. I believe if a court is to look at that, a fixed amount, we've discussed this in our office, a fixed amount is likely to mean not imposed as a result of a calculation. Now, if this question were to go before a court and if there is that issue that's litigated, the court's going to go through the steps, either statutory construction or constitutional interpretation steps that we see in Boley and that we also now see in Gaines, and start by looking at the text. And it's our belief that the fixed amount is fixed for a particular taxpayer. Of course, we can't predict what at the end what a court is actually going to say, but to suggest that somehow it's carved out from the rest of the tax that taxpayer is paying, I think it seems that it's a stretch to do that. I don't know that a court looking at it in the context of legislative intent and also the intent of the voters in passing the constitutional provision would somehow separate that.
So, Mr. Chair, so what you're saying is that the whole corporate minimum system, the $150 and the calculation, you're saying that the most likely interpretation that you would predict is that they would both be covered?
That is our belief, Senator Burdick. Looking at it as opposed to something that is not fixed, that requires application of some multiplier to an amount, and a court would look to seek a plain language interpretation of this, and what does a fixed amount mean? I think contrasting it with something where it's not fixed, where it requires some sort of multiplication, makes the most sense, as opposed to trying to dissect the amount paid by a taxpayer subject to the alternative to the minimum.
Okay. Representative Brewer and then Representative Wand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so on the kicker, as we're looking to segregate out the corporate fixed amount and such. The Constitution, when it was contemplated, we didn't have a minimum tax for partnerships. So how is the 150 minimum tax for partnerships contemplated in the kicker formulas?
Representative Brewer, we would interpret that as being part of the personal income tax calculation, so that this particular language in the Constitution refers to corporate only. So they would not be included in that corporate adjustment.
If I might challenge that thought, if we could have more conversation about that, because I'm not sure how partnership minimum tax gets included in individual, and I'd maybe like some further conversation on that, seeing how a partner in a partnership may be an individual or a corporation, and so or a trust or whoever knows what.
Yeah.
So maybe some further conversation on that and thought on that.
We'll look into that.
Yeah, Representative Wand.
Thanks. I'm fascinated by this discussion about fixed amount. And where my thought originally goes to is the kind of a substance over form argument that we typically see in tax discussions, where a minimum tax of, say, $100 would be likely a fixed amount. But then a minimum tax that's $100 if your gross is $50,000, and $200 if your gross is $100,000, and $300, and so on and so forth, is somehow morphed into a not fixed amount. And when I think through substance over form, I think that that might be a weakness in the analysis. That was more of a comment than a question, I suppose, but I'm interested in input. So.
Thank you. I think that LC has responded to that issue.
Okay.
I think that she's also said, you tell me if I've got this right, that that's a question of interpretation, and the court may very well be asked that question.
Chair Barnhart, I believe that right there may be, that's the question, and what does it mean to be a fixed amount? And it's also a fixed amount it's a tax that is imposed as a fixed amount in the context of being a minimum tax. So the court's going to have to look at the entire context and also look at legislative intent and also the intent of the voters. But those are the arguments. The argument, the contrary, would be it's not fixed because it varies by taxpayer.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, we had a couple of other issues on the back. So. And I just, Chris has worked on these issues, so I'll ask him to briefly go through.
Let me just note that I understand there's no other meeting in here at 11, so we may run over just a couple minutes. At least one member has to leave for another meeting. Go ahead.
The two issues, and we've lumped them under this corporate minimum tax, involve the use of credits against the minimum and also possible interpretation for airlines through a federal statute. So I'll turn it over to Chris.
Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chairs, for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. The first piece, under the corporate tax credits, pertains to the notion of using tax credits to reduce or offset or pay or satisfy, I'm not sure exactly which the proper word would be the minimum tax. And this is an issue that is currently before the tax court. And as karma would have it, the taxpayer involved has claimed a Betsy credit and has argued that the use of the credit can be used to offset their minimum tax. They had a minimum tax of, I think it was $75,000. And when they filed their tax return, they said, well, we have a Betsy, so of greater than $75,000, so we don't owe anything. And the Department of Revenue said that's not our interpretation of statute, and insisted that they owed the $75,000. And so, long story short, they are currently before the tax court on that question of whether or not tax credits can be used to satisfy the obligation of the minimum tax. And I'm not a lawyer, but I don't want to go into all, I think their arguments are multifaceted, but one piece of it is that second bullet point. And aside from the kicker, there is one tax credit, the tax credit for contributions of computer equipment, that specifically says that the credit allowed under that section shall not be allowed against the corporate minimum tax. The bracket there, corporate minimum tax, in the actual statute, it's the reference to 317.090. And so I think there's some interpretation about, well, if that credit specifically says it can't be used against the minimum tax, yes, then what about all of the other tax credits that don't have that specific language? I'm not trying to highlight one point above others, but that is, I believe the plaintiffs had kind of a multifaceted argument, but that is one aspect.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
In the case before the tax court, you imply in this report, which may or may not be true, that they bought the credits subsequent to the tax, to the minimum tax. What about if they bought the tax credit and then we changed the tax code? And is there any difference in the?
To the Representative Berger, to the point on the specifics of the case, I don't know when this taxpayer bought the tax credit, but in terms of whether or not that would matter, I would.
What do you think, Kate? Because I have heard from a constituent on this very, very issue.
I have looked at the pleadings in this matter. I'm not entirely certain, but I believe they actually acquired the credit. They were not the original purchaser. It was a transferee of the credit, and it deals with the 2009 tax year during which the change was made. I'm not certain.
Well,
they didn't already possess the credit.
So the tax court is not, because in the case of my constituent, it was their Betsy. It wasn't a purchase transfer, and it was purchased before we implemented 67, and so has there been any interpretations in the court as whether they're just, as we say, SOL in terms of not being able to use these credits because we are now imposing a minimum, where before it was based on their expected income tax liabilities going forward?
I believe they did purchase the credit and receive the certificate before 2009, and then it was for the 2009 tax year, but I'm not 100% certain.
Okay, well, I will pursue this later, but the CPAs are nodding mm-hmm. down here. They've
this
seen
will be
it
a fun
too,
one.
And it is an important issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, it has lots of other impacts.
Yes.
Tell her, yeah. Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that the how this court case is settled is going to have other impacts. I mean, we're already thinking about protective claims with tax returns.
Well,
and
of course, all major legislation ends up with things that you hadn't thought about or didn't clarify completely originally, and this not at all surprising. Representative Brewer.
I was just going to say something that this tax court and potentially the findings are a CPA job creator bill. just wanted to say that.
You're so happy.
Right. Yes, please.
Okay, there aren't any other questions about the last point here is gets it to the question of the interpretation of the minimum tax. And that's been discussed a little bit here and as well in the past, exactly what is the minimum tax. And two interpretations are, one is that it's part and parcel of the excise tax, or two, it's a separate alternative minimum tax or alternative tax or a tax on gross receipts. And the interpretation of what is that tax can have ramifications. And the second bullet point there under that pertains to the airlines. There is a federal preemption of airline, basically saying that airlines are not required to pay a gross receipts tax. So if the corporate minimum tax is deemed to be a gross receipts tax, then that would preclude airlines from paying it. And there could be other implications as well, depending on what this is officially deemed to be.
And do we have an estimate of what the amounts are that airlines are paying of this particular tax?
Mr. Chair, I haven't looked at the estimates for any of these issues yet. It's definitely on our radar screen, and it's most definitely on my to-do list. But I don't have numbers that I could share today.
Co-Chair Berger.
It's my understanding that this, too, is being litigated. In other words, that there are folks looking at this, and is anyone asking for a legislative language change on this?
Representative Berger, I haven't.
For clarification, I should say that that the corporate minimum is this or that.
I haven't heard that it's risen exactly to that level. I'm not aware of a case in front of the tax court, for example, but everything looks like it's heading
that
direction.
Way. Yeah, I'm aware of this one. Okay, yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions, comments? How are we doing on our agenda?
I think we're fine, Mr. Chair. I just say, in kind of concluding comment on these issues, of course, we're tracking them, and we'll report back to you. The first one around the kicker, I don't see as a major revenue issue. If you were to pull out the broad definition of the corporate minimum, it would make the kicker somewhat more likely, because that's a more predictable part of the corporate income tax. But as long as we know prior to that and have included in the close of session, then I think it's something that would be pretty straightforward. The second issue around the credits would be a significant revenue impact, because you'd be using credits against the corporate minimum. So we are looking at some significant dollars in that case. And as Chris said, in terms of the individual industry around the airlines, we don't know on that one. Explore that further to see what that potential risk is, but we'll be working on those and monitoring these issues.
Of course, our approach when the tax measure that we adopted was being considered was that you used one kind of calculation to calculate a tax based on income, and a different approach for the purpose of considering a tax based on Oregon sales, and you paid whichever one was bigger. And the one that included income was the one that had tax credits applied to it. There's no reference to applying tax credits against the one that applied to the calculation of Oregon sales. And so my assumption has always been that tax credits would not apply against the corporate minimum tax, because it's calculated in a completely different way.
Mr. Chair, I would challenge that a bit. I don't remember being in the room in that discussion being part of our record. And I think that a tax owed and a tax credit ought to be sort of equal unless we specify, and I think we've had some interesting discussion here about, you know, in one place and only one place in law it is specified, and I think this is a very worthy discussion for further review.
Well, I would agree, Representative Berger, that a review of the record to actually see what the record contains about our intent would be useful. I think what I've said describes pretty well what those of us who worked intimately on the bill thought that it was what it said. Whether it can be demonstrated that the legislature meant that or not is a different question.
Exactly.
And Mr. Chair, just a comment on the airline industry. It's further complicated by the fact that the airline industry is getting so much of their revenue now from these fees that are, as I understand it, are not taxed. So they're likely to be even more, we're likely to be even more reliant on the minimum tax for the airlines than we would otherwise before these fees started becoming so dominant. The fees are just huge. And you do have to kind of wonder whether Congress is going to reach a point where...
And fees are not income?
Why aren't they taxed? They're revenue.
It's my understanding. Now, please correct me if I'm wrong. I would be delighted to be corrected on this, because I've always understood it to be a major loophole in the federal and state tax.
I suspect as this develops, we'll get more information.
Yeah.
Right.
Maybe you could take that on, Chris, how they are treated.
We have two more meetings this year, one to receive the revenue estimate and one in December?
January.
In January. Okay, one in January. We need to have committee bills proposed by the next meeting.
The deadline for requesting a draft is December 5th.
Right, which is after our revenue estimate meeting, but before our other meeting. So if members have issues that they want to raise around bill introduction, please contact the co-chairs for the Senate, of course, obviously the chair, and the LRO as we work on that. And I would suggest that members ought to coordinate where possible on their personal bill introductions when it relates to revenue issues so that we can, given that we only have a very limited number of bills we're allowed to bring in February, that we actually cover the waterfront. Anything else? Thank you very much. We're only 9 minutes over. House Committee on Revenue is adjourned.
Finance and Revenue is adjourned.